you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. Thank you for tuning in to the very first Twilight Histories show. If you're new to the Twilight Histories, let me explain what you're about to hear. It's a little different than anything you've probably heard before. This is a fiction podcast with stories dramatized with music and sound effects to heighten the experience. The idea is that you are a time traveler sent to alternate worlds in the multiverse. Some are familiar, others totally exotic. You'll meet Aztecs armed with steel and explore a steam-powered Rome. You'll wander the swamps of Venus with dinosaurs and try to escape a death cult in a Carthaginian colony on Mars. That's right, you are the hero in these stories. You are the main character. And in case that sounds a bit weird, it's actually more common than you might think. When you're playing a video game, you often play from the point of view of the main character. And if you've ever played D&D or read game books like Fighting Fantasy or Choose Your Own Adventure, you can imagine these shows as story versions of campaigns. Today's show is one of the very first I ever made, so it's a little rusty and it has its quirks. One of its quirks is that it's gender specific. It's the one show where the you character is a man. I very quickly changed this and made future shows gender neutral, and I chalk this as a newbie mistake. Ultimately, I decided to keep this show regardless, as I feel there's something special about it. I've been told this by many listeners over the years, and to be honest, there is something different about it. It has a kind of magic that I've always tried to recreate, but I never feel I quite touch. It could just be my imagination. Maybe it's nostalgia for those early days when the Twilight Histories was very new. I don't know. Regardless, I hope you enjoy today's show, Ice Age Misery, and welcome to the world of the Twilight Histories.
Well, I see you've signed the contract and released us from all liability. You've decided to take the plunge and do some real time travel. As your time travel consultant, I have calibrated the machine and will now give you your orientation. For your first real journey, you are about to travel to a very different world. To give you an idea of where you'll be headed, just follow this little thought experiment. Imagine the Earth had a sister planet a bit further out, not unlike Mars, but with an atmosphere, animals, plants. This world is alien and strange by our standards, and it's much, much colder. It is so cold that it is almost uninhabitable, and only the most adept creatures can survive here. Creatures with thick hides and long fur. Temperatures can plummet in moments. Great ice storms can hurtle across the alien plains. Dramatic landscapes of incredible beauty can startle the senses. Into this hostile and extreme alien world will be dropped some humans. Not many. On a continent that looks vaguely like Europe. A population roughly the size of our world's baboons will be scattered across the landscape. How would this tiny, scattered population fare? With nothing more than their intellect, could they survive on this alien world? And if you were to leave them on this planet for tens of thousands, no, hundreds of thousands of years, what would they look like? What culture, what art, what language, religion, and technology would they develop? You're sending me back to the Ice Age, you say? I am sending you back to the Garden of Eden, the place where it all began. But this garden isn't tropical, and there is no fruit. There is ice, and there is suffering. Death is sudden and expected. But you're a time traveler, and on the form you checked the box that said High Adventure. Yes, but I wanted to see the Romans. I wanted the Renaissance, you say. Patience. You will get your artists and your famous battles. But there's a hazing process. First, you must learn to survive. You must learn to adapt to new cultures. You can't just blend into the Ice Age. You have to become the people you're exploring. If you don't, you will die. This is not what I signed up for, you say. No? Well, be warned. Once you're there, you may not want to come back. It's happened before. We've had people choose not to return. You have gone through days of testing. You have a computer chip inserted in your brain. Whatever languages you come across, they will be translated, and you will be able to speak them. You have already received your haircut, and your clothing hangs on those hooks. Please put them on now while I finish your orientation. You are going to be dropped off in the Ice Age, sometime around 20,000 years ago. Your starting point is somewhere in southern England. We are not able to control when you come back. It may be a few months. It may be a few years. If there's an emergency, we cannot rescue you. Well, you look great. Are you ready? Do you feel up to this? If you're not a bit nervous, there'd be something wrong with you. So go on, step in. You're going to feel a bit strange, and you might have difficulty remembering where you are at first. But don't worry, that'll wear off. Good luck. Some parting words of advice. Be open. Listen to them. And get out of your head. That's the only way you're going to survive. You can feel the ice crunching under your feet as you walk blindly into a wall of white. There are no features, no trees. There is no horizon. There is only the snow blasting sideways, first from one direction, then whipping around and blasting you from another. You trudge on, lost and disoriented. You can't remember where you are. You aren't sure how you got here. All you feel is an intense fear bridging on panic. You must move forward. But where is forward? How can you get out of this storm? You are tiring. Your furs are thick, but the snow has seeped down your neck and back. Your feet are wet and cold and are starting to ache. Bursts of energetic panic are punctuated by long spells of exhaustion. You sit in the snow, catch your breath. You can no longer feel your fingers or toes. Your eyelids are starting to sag. Just a moment of rest, you say to yourself. That's all you need. Just a moment. Of rest. You fade in and out of consciousness, and your dreams start to meld with reality. There are dark shapes moving in the storm. You can't tell if they're near or far, real or dreamed. Your eyes are so heavy. You fall asleep. You wake, disoriented and unsure where you are. The pungent smell of cured skin and smoke fills your nose. It is dark, but you can feel the warm embers of a fire heating the side of your body. You're wrapped snugly in fur blankets. On your right, you can feel the walls, a skin canvas, shuddering with every blast of howling wind. You try desperately to remember where you are, and your mind races through the dull ache of exhaustion. It is like waking up in a new apartment for the first time and not quite knowing where you are, only this is much worse. There's something about time travel that can be so taxing on the mind. Time travel. Right. Wherever you are, at least you are safe now. Safe and warm. You fall back asleep. It is morning. The wind has died and the room is filled with early morning light that seeps through cracks and illuminates the skin walls. You are warm under your fur blankets, but you can still feel a chill on your exposed face, making you not want to get out of bed. The tent flap opens, and the silhouette of what looks like a bear walks in. You jump up with a start, and the bear stops. Then it laughs. It is a man wrapped in layers of thick fur. Even his face is covered. The man tugs off his long gloves and pulls down the fur covering his face. His skin is leathery and sallow. His eyes are piercing and demand obedience, but you can tell his strength comes from something other than muscle. His smile, so quick to form when he saw you jump, loosens to what must be his regular sad scowl. He sighs and speaks. What family are you from? He lists some family names. You mutter that you aren't sure, you don't remember. He looks at you oddly, then shrugs. I'm Braun, he says. Welcome to our family. He points at the ground near your feet, where a pile of furs lies. He tells you to put them on. They were my brothers, he says as he leaves the tent. He died last night. You step out of the tent and are immediately greeted by a wall of ice that towers to the sky behind you. You turn to see it stretching on and on into the distance as far as you can see. Then you turn once more and see it stretching in that direction as well. Glaciers, says a young woman's voice behind you. You turn to see a fur-clad person you assume must be a woman. She pulls down the fur that covers her face. She is a young and attractive woman with a stern face and troubled eyes. They're moving fast, she says, motioning to the glaciers, and as if on cue, a massive chunk of ice breaks off far in the distance and crashes into the snow. We have to move. Days pass, and you cross the snow-filled plains, one painful step at a time, always heading towards the sun and away from the glaciers. You travel all day, from the early morning till the sun begins to set behind the hills. There are no hours of daylight wasted, and your tired body aches from the strain of constant hiking through snow. And you are hungry. The band is running out of food, and you have not yet seen any animals. One day, the band is spread out. Anyone who is able-bodied is to scavenge the land for food, while the older members and the children slowly pull the tents on sleighs. You trek off with Braun and the young woman, who you learn is his daughter, Nina. There is desperation in their faces. This is almost suicidal. There isn't enough food to feed even the strongest band members, let alone hunt for the entire group. People are going to start dying. You scavenge the land all day. In the evening, as the sun sets, the man and his daughter capture a rabbit, and there is great excitement. They have an insane look on their faces, as though this small creature is life itself. And it is. A small fire is made from twigs dug from beneath the snow, and the animal is cooked and consumed. This is the first cooked meat you've eaten in a week, and although your portion is small, your stomach aches and turns. Nina isn't eating her portion, and Braun, seeing into her heart, reminds her this is not enough to feed the whole band. They have to find something more substantial. She looks at him angrily and bites into the meat. The next morning, you rise early, and with a hungry stomach, trudge on into the flurries of snow. Your small party has not walked more than half an hour before you almost stumble over a cliff. Before you is spread a deep, snow-filled valley that stretches beyond the horizon. This can be only one thing: the English Channel. Nina shouts and points into the valley. "There," she says, "a herd." You and the man gaze into the valley and see some small, dark spots off in the distance, shrouded by gusts of falling snow. "No, it is," she says, not waiting for you to decide for yourselves. "Come on." You are in the valley, the English Channel. Behind you are the white cliffs of Dover. In a world as strange as this one, it only feels stranger that you are walking where one day crabs will scuttle. It's an eerie feeling. You take your glove off and bend down. You place your hand into the footprint left by the person in front of you and draw the crunchy ice-encrusted grass through your fingers. In the spring, this must be a rich, fertile plain. "Come on," says Nina, and you rise and continue into the freezing wind. The tracks of the herd Nina saw are gone. "If they ever existed," you mumble hungrily to yourself. You are so hungry now, you can hardly move one foot in front of the other, and you lumber on, head bent over, back arched under the weight of your pack, and arms dangling limp at your sides, pulling you off balance. All you can see, all you care about, are the footprints in front of you, one foot in front of the other. That night, the little band experiences its second casualty since you arrived. She was an old woman, the eldest in the band. You wonder how she could have made it so long. The band is obviously shaken. Everyone called her either mother or grandmother. No one has the strength to bury her. You are scavenging once more with your adopted guides. You seem to have made it to the other side of the valley. This is France, or perhaps Belgium. You don't really care. All you want is to roll over and die. You move past the cliffs and up into the hills. There are more trees here, which may be a good sign. It means you are getting further from the ice shelf and closer to where things can actually live. Your guides are hoping they will find game in the woods. It is much easier to hunt when there's a tree cover than out in the open plains. Nina and Bronn both have spears with deadly sharp stone tips bound with skin twine. They have bows and stone-tipped arrows. You are given a net by Nina for when an animal needs to be snared. Father and daughter move stealthily through the woods, and though you are hungry, you feel as though there has been a change. They seem confident. Bronn spots some fresh tracks in the snow, a buck. These tracks may only be an hour or so old. You feel your heart beating faster, though your fear of killing a creature was shaken somewhat by the death of the rabbit. You wonder how you will be able to deal with a large animal. And there it is, a great buck standing proud amongst the lofty trees. You've never looked at a creature with an intention to kill it before, at least nothing larger than the rabbit. And it's huge. You watch its muscular legs move easily through the brush, and you count the thick husks of antler and wonder if it would be more dangerous approaching from the front or the back. Two arrows suddenly appear in the buck's chest, and it tears off into the woods. The hunters, Nina and Bronn, rise from their hiding spots on either side of the clearing. You are confused. It got away. Shouldn't we chase it, you ask? No, it will die, says Bronn. We'll catch it in a few days. You walk deeper into the woods, following the footsteps of the buck, punctuated by drops of blood. Oh, that was easy, you think to yourself. The snow is coming down hard, and you can hardly see without squinting. The buck is limping in front of you, its antlers gnashing dangerously in wide, violent arcs. You can see its warm breath panting out in bursts. The two arrows are broken stubs, but the blood is everywhere, made more shocking by its stark contrast with the snow. The two hunters split up. You are in the center with your net, and Bronn and Nina move around to each flank. How did I get the center, you ask yourself, feeling stupid and useless with your net. The three of you inch in closer, and the animal screams in fury, first swinging towards you, then towards Nina, then her father. It limps backwards. Nina throws her spear. Its razor point drives home into the flank, but the buck isn't stopped. It can't be standing after that, you think. Seeing that Nina is unarmed, it races at her. Throw your net, calls Bronn, and you run up and hurl the net at the antlers. Bronn races forward and drives his spear into the beast. It wildly bucks at him, and then they both disappear. You walk forward. Stop, calls out Nina. She catches up to you, appearing out of the whiteness of the snow. She holds your arm and you inch forward together. There, not a foot in front of you, is the edge of the cliff. Below, about 20 feet down, you see Bronn and the buck. Both are motionless. You and Nina pull her father into a cave at the bottom of the cliff. He's still unconscious, though breathing irregularly, and there's blood on his face. You think maybe he's broken some ribs, or perhaps even punctured a lung. You can't tell if the blood on his face is from the buck, or from him. Nina tells you to go and gather firewood and bring in the buck. She is obviously upset and seems on the verge of panic. You go out into the woods and soon return with an armful of wood. "Hurry, hurry," she says, and flakes some wood into kindling, which she ignites by rubbing a stick into a piece of wood. "Go out and get more. We need much more." You go back into the woods and gather more wood, not sure what the big rush is. But imagine, it's for warming up her father, or perhaps just to keep her mind occupied in this stressful situation. You return, and she again demands more. She looks scared now and urgent. She keeps looking all around the cave and at the entrance. She hands you bronze spear. "Hurry," she whispers. Now she has you spooked. The hairs on your neck stand on end. Why did she give you the spear? She seemed to be looking more at the walls of the cave than at her wounded father. When you come back with your hands full yet again, you see she's built a wall of wood around the entrance of the cave, which is now hissing and popping and billowing with smoke. You step past the wood and into the cave entrance. You see a small fire way at the back of the cave. And there she is. She's melted some snow in a leather pouch over the fire and is clearing Bronn's face. A piece of meat is slowly roasting. "It's not safe here," she says. "Is that enough wood?" "Why isn't it safe?" you ask. "Look," she says, and pulls a piece of wood from the fire. She shines the flame against the walls of the cave. Long, deep gouges are everywhere in the frozen rock. "Nothing could claw into the rock like that," you think to yourself. As if anticipating your skepticism, she shines her torch down at the ground. "Look," she says. There is a skull sticking out of the thick, gooey mud. It's at least 3 feet long and a foot tall. It has massive teeth, sharp like razors. "Cave bear," she says. "There are fresh remains. We can't stay long." Now the fear kicks in. Your knees tremble. You suddenly feel claustrophobic. You grab a piece of wood and look all around the cave. There are claw marks everywhere. There are bones of so many creatures. The dank smell that fills your nostrils is the smell of death. "Don't panic," she says. "We have to stay for now, but it will be back soon. It's getting dark." "Okay, what should we do?" you ask. "This is not the end of the cave," she says. "It goes deeper. Here, feel this." She takes your hand and places it into the darkness. You feel a slight breeze. She shines the torch at the back of the cave where you see rocks have collapsed in. "Dig," she says. "I'll take care of Father." Within an hour or so, you've made a hole in the top of the rubble and can feel the stale air flowing out of it. You shine a torch into the hole. The flames flickering against the walls of the inner chamber play with your imagination, and you think you see giant spiders, fanged beasts, and giant rats everywhere. Your heart is beating and you violently pull yourself out. "Is it big enough to crawl through?" calls Nina. "Yes, but there's no way we're going in there," you say sternly. For the first time, she looks genuinely frustrated with you and grabs your torch. She crawls through the hole so only her legs are sticking out. After a moment, she crawls back. "Good," she says, looking at you with disappointment. "Grab the meat and pull it in. Then bring in the wood." There's something about the way she speaks that makes you obey. After you've completed your chores, she tells you to crawl through the hole. She'll pass you her father, carefully. Together, you drag her father up to the hole. You crawl in. She lifts his limp arms and passes them to you. You grab his wrists and begin to pull. And then she tells you to hush. "What is it?" you ask. "Shh." In a panicked, hushed voice, she says, "Move, move, move!" You heave on the arms of the comatose man, but halfway through the entrance, the bulk of his jacket gets stuck. "Move it," she snaps. "It's here." You rip at his clothes, trying to loosen them. You can feel her tearing at the clothes from her end. Oh, mother," she calls out as if in prayer. You yank violently at the clothes, but your mittened fingers can't get a good grip. You pull them off and grab hold of Bron's clothes once more. You hear Nina crying on the other side. The torch rolls over and you can't see it. You reach your hands into the hole and rip wildly at the clothes. Finally, they loosen and you manage to get them over a snag. You heave the dead weight in. Nina reaches into the hole and you grab her hand. "Pull me," she hisses, and you yank her in. She lands on top of you. Not a moment later, you see a massive clawed bear paw the size of your entire body burst through the hole. Its claw clanks at the walls and rips into the rock, tearing at it and sending chunks tumbling to the ground. The cave bear roars and reaches its paw in further, rocks rolling down the heap you're lying in. You can see its hot breath bursting into the room, puffs like a steam engine. Nina raises her spear and slams it into the paw. The bear screams. "Come on," she says. Together, you lift her father and carry him deeper into the cave. You find yourself in a magnificent cavern. The crystals that dot every wall twinkle as you pass your torch in front of them, and even the deep chambers where your dim light can't quite reach twinkle in the distance. Huge stalagmites tower up from the ground and meet the dangling icicles of liquid carbon that seep down from the melting ceiling. You think you see a hand in the rock, and your heart skips a beat. Were you imagining it? Like you did earlier when you first passed your torch in the other chamber? But when you shine the torch back on the wall, you indeed see a hand. It is made of paint, a handprint in the stone. As you walk by the walls, you see more handprints. Nina appears from the darkness. "This is the womb of our mother," she says. "This cave is the birthplace of life. It's a very powerful place." She sees you looking at the handprints. "We can connect with the mother. Do you want to try?" she asks. She looks around her on the ground. She finds a stick of charcoal, probably used by the last artist. She crumbles it into her hand and brings her hands up to her lips, adds some saliva, and makes a paste. She puts some of the paste into your own hands and tells you to rub it together. You watch as she places her hands on the walls of the cave, her eyes closed, lips moving in silence. When she's done, she looks at you. "You haven't done it yet." "I don't know what to do," you say. She takes one of your hands and slowly presses it against the wall, her hand on top of yours. "Let's pray for Father," she says. "Ask for healing." You can hear her muted words under her breath, next to your ear, her hand sticky and cold against the twinkling diamond wall. But very conscious of her touch. As you close your eyes, you feel something strange inside you. A peacefulness comes over you when you feel strangely safe with Nina whispering in your ear. For a moment, your imagination flashes and you feel as though this isn't a cave at all, but perhaps, just maybe, the womb of the Mother Goddess. But there is no healing, and after waking up next to Nina, after what seems like days, you see her awake, her body shuddering in the light of the embers. She uses the charcoal from the fire to paint the plump, pregnant belly of the Mother Goddess into a large stalactite that hangs from the center of the chamber. The breasts of the goddess hang over the great belly and the small, round head, with no facial features, almost disappears behind its shoulders. "Life," she says, while tears roll down her face. "We need life." There is a passageway at the back of the chamber. You and Nina spend some hours passing through small cracks that break into brilliant new chambers, glimmering like diamonds. You wade through ice-cold subterranean pools that rise to your knees. The passage begins to rise, and you crawl through a tight channel in the rock, with a fresh smell of living pine and snow in your noses. And then, finally, you break through, crawling out of the cave as if born new. You aren't sure how many days you spent in the womb of the mother, but the sun rising over the hills could not be more beautiful. Whatever pain you felt, whatever suffering through hunger and exhaustion, and whatever suffering lies ahead of you, this moment, crawling from the dark earth and seeing the sun's light and feeling the cool, scented air on your face, this moment is good. You and Nina spend days searching for the band. You aren't sure how you'll find them, but she is adamant. It is her family, after all. You eventually find the entrance to the cave bear's home, and steering well clear, you find your way up to the top of the cliff. From there, Nina tracks her way back through the woods. The snow is much deeper than it had been, as though there'd been a great storm while you were in the cave. Eventually, you find your way to the place where you had left the camp. There is nothing. Nothing but snow. "They must have left," says Nina. She is exasperated. She walks around the tree line, looking for clues. Something in the snow makes you stop. It looks like a piece of skin rag sticking out of the ground. You pull at it, but it won't budge. You drop to your knees and dig into the snow. The rag grows larger, and soon you see a wooden pole stuck within it. In horror, you realize this is not a rag, but a tent. You look around and see mounds in the snow all around the clearing. Nina is still running from tree to tree, searching for some kind of clue as to where her family could have gone. "Nina," you say, choking on her name. She turns to see you kneeling awkwardly in the middle of the clearing, part of the tent in your hand. You come to a river. This is good because you can fish at a river, and Nina knows how to fish. Things are different between you and Nina. She is much quieter now, and she seems to lack any kind of purpose. Only momentum keeps you hiking from day to day, as if chasing a dream that has already died. And Nina seems to be getting sick. Sometimes she will wake up in the morning and vomit. You try to take care of her as best you can, but you are concerned for her. As the days pass, she is able to travel less and less. You aren't sure if it's because of her illness or because she has lost her resolve. Because you have to take on more responsibility, you are forced to learn how to fish on your own, how to start a fire using sticks and wood shavings, and how to knap stone tools using the thick ends of bones. You learn to set traps for animals, and you can even kill and skin them yourself. Although Nina is often moody with you and seems depressed, staring off down the river, she ravenously eats whatever you bring to the camp. The days are becoming longer and the snow has turned to a crunchy ice that makes your furs wet when you walk through it. You start to hear birds and the river grows louder with each passing day. Some days you even feel warm and have to untie your furs. It rains from time to time, a slushy, icy rain that forces you to find cover. You come to a bend in the river where a larger body of shallow water is trapped. Your hunter's instinct tells you this is a great place to fish, and that has the double benefit of attracting animals to the riverside that you can hunt. "Why don't we stay here so you can rest," you say to Nina, after you have set up the tent and are preparing the bedding. "This is a good spot." She agrees with you that this is a good place, but is leery of staying here. The more you implore her, the more adamant she becomes that you leave. "Tomorrow," she says. After some arguing, she finally admits to you she thinks she's pregnant. It takes you a moment to swallow her words. You are momentarily stunned, and the clarity of all your thoughts and arguments is thrown into a scattered frenzy that leaves you speechless. You are a time traveler, a tourist of time. This cannot be happening to you. She is looking at you very carefully, watching your face as it battles against this twisted reasoning. "What is it?" she finally asks, no longer able to take the silence. "We should stay," you whisper, covering your thoughts with the immediacy of your situation. "We can have the baby here. There are fish. I can hunt. There are berries and roots." You start explaining your ideas for gathering plants and farming them, even catching an animal and domesticating it. But she is shaking her head as though none of what you say touches the deeper issue. "Your ideas are good, but we can't stay here. You have to understand that spring is short. It will be winter soon. It will be winter when we have the baby. And then the ground will be covered in snow as high as you stand. This river will freeze down to the mud. We will die, and so will the baby." "The only way we can survive, the only way, is if we find others. We can't do this alone. With others, we can hunt large game, even find a herd to live off of. With others, we can divide the tasks. If we get sick, there are others to feed us. If we are injured, others can care for us. We need to find other people. Do you understand?" "Be open," you remember. "Get out of your head. Listen to them." All right, we'll leave tomorrow. You place your hand on the slight bulge of her stomach. She smiles at you, thankfully. You can't help but feel at peace in her eyes. Three days down the river, you find the first humans outside Nina's family. At first, you see the curling smoke of a fire rising in the distance above the trees. You feel an excitement welling up inside you and begin to walk faster. Nina cautions you to slow down. She has that look of concern in her eye again, like she did at the cave. What is it this time, you say in frustration? There are people over there. Let's just be cautious, she says. Following her lead, you walk into the woods, away from the riverbank, and slowly, quietly, move towards the smoke. Within what seems like an hour, you are within sight of a skin tent on the beach. A fire crackles under a bed of smoked fish. Around the fire sit three men with long hair. They are wrapped in furs. Come on, you say, and begin to get up. No, wait, she says. I don't like this. You pull her hand off your arm and step out into the clearing. The three men turn, grab their spears, staring at you. You instantly regret not listening to Nina. Hello, you say awkwardly. They instinctively begin to circle you, just as you did to the buck so long ago. This is very bad, you think to yourself in a cold sweat. You drop your own spear and raise your hands, but they continue to circle you. Nina jumps up from behind you and into the clearing. This adds some confusion to the hunters. You see her looking to the ground and holding her hands up, a string of shell beads from her homeland dangling from them. She orders you in an angry whisper to drop to the ground. You both place your hands in the sand, your eyes down. One of the hunters kicks away your spear. Another uses his spear to pick up the necklace. All you can see are their feet, and you are terrified. You could be stabbed at any moment, like the buck, and there is nothing you can do about it. Nothing. Except run, and you desperately want to do just that. Where did you get these? Says a gruff voice in a heavy accent. From the land nearest the ice star, says Nina. They are shells taken from the sea. There is a long pause, and it sounds like they are passing the shells around. I've heard of the sea, mutters one of the men. How many days to the ice star? We've walked for 80 or 90 days. That's where the ice is. Is there anyone else? No, they died in the ice. We're the last ones alive. We're looking to join a new band. The hunters speak with each other in hushed voices. Finally, one of them says, there is a tribe down the river, 3 weeks' journey. We'll take you there. You look at Nina with a little jab of triumph. She looks back at you with daggers. That night, you sit around the fire with the hunters. The conversation is less than enlightened. They ignore you, and when you try to join in, they stare at you coldly. They seem more interested in Nina, although she keeps her eyes low and only speaks in one or two word replies. You find out through their conversation that they don't have a band of their own. They travel the river and trade with different groups. The one they are heading to is the big one. There are over 150 people in this tribe, an Ice Age metropolis. If what they say is true. They also say the tribe lives off a great herd of mammoths. There is a mammoth graveyard where all the mammoths go to die. It gives them enough food to live, so there is no need to move. They can stay there year-round and always have enough to eat. They talk about the great houses made of mammoth bone and packed earth, buildings that can withstand any storm and that are large enough to hold 20 people. They talk about all the wealth. They make the best tools, finely crafted blades, axes, and needles. They even make vessels made from clay and are painted and can earn a fortune in other communities up the river. And they talk about the women, always the women. It makes you feel uncomfortable the way they are speaking about women. Nina keeps looking at the ground. Eventually you get up. Nina rises with you, but the men beg her to stay. She ignores them and continues into the dark with you. "This is dangerous," she whispers. The next day, when you wake in the tent, you have it in mind to part from the men. You are about to wake Nina when you hear the sounds of the men down by the river outside your tent. There is no escape. You walk in silence down the river. The tension is palpable. It seems pretty obvious that these men do not want you here. They want Nina. They've already made a name for you. Baby Duck. They think it's brilliant, and the one man who made it up keeps congratulating himself on his wit. Baby Duck, the little one who keeps quacking but can't fly with the hawks. The jeering moves from tedious to insidious, and by nighttime you are seriously afraid, both for you and for Nina. There is no escape, you think. If you are to reach this tribe, there is only one path, and you are all going down it together. The way they are speaking to Nina, you begin to wonder if they would even let her go. Their words have grown stronger. The words come first, you think, then the actions. Try to leave the campfire early that night. One of the men points his spear at you and tells you to go. Another of the men grabs Nina's arm. She lets out a shriek and hits him. You move in and grab hold of her arm and yank her away, but feel a sharp kick on your back and fall over Nina and the other men. You roll down the rocky beach and splash into the river. You hear Nina screaming, but the fire is hidden by the dark shape of a man in front of you, spear raised. You run through the water and hear the man jumping into the current behind you. This is it. He is going to kill you. His stone spear, the point as sharp as a razor, is going to flay you open. Your back tingles in the anticipation of the blow as you run desperately through the water and then up the rocky beach to the dark shape that is your tent. Next to the door is a spear. You grab it and turn. Instantly, you feel the thud of the point entering the shadow that's chasing you. First, you feel the stiff bone of the ribs, which separate, then crack. Then, the easy slide of the spear through the chest. The feeling is awful, like killing an animal, but this is a man. You can feel the sticky, wet blood pouring over you. There is so much of it. You hear Nina screaming and the other men yelling curses at her. You call out in a voice that doesn't seem your own. It is the voice of someone fiercer than you. It is a deeper, raspier, crazier voice than yours. You yell out that you have killed the man, and now you are going to kill them. There is silence. Only the popping of the fire and the rustling of the river can be heard. From Nina and the men, nothing. You push off the dying man and rise. You pick up his spear and your own and walk toward the fire. The two men, their pants down at their ankles, stare at you in horror. You raise one of your spears, and the two men yelp and jump up, tripping over their pants as they try desperately to get away from you. Nina grabs your arm and tells you to stop. You turn to her, the adrenaline still coursing through your veins, and she looks at you in horror. "Is this your blood?" she asks fearfully. The next day, you leave the camp and continue on your journey downriver. Things have definitely improved between you and Nina. You are shaken by what happened last night, but she thinks it's great. She looks at you adoringly and makes every excuse to hold your arm. It is a leisurely journey down the river, but Nina is not feeling well. She hides it, of course. She shows a stoicism you wouldn't wish on yourself. Her stomach is really starting to swell. It strikes you one day, after hiking for weeks, that the men could have been lying. There might not be a tribe down this river. Or what if this tribe is filled with people like those men? Is it safe to bring Nina to this place? And what if they won't let you in? Or what if they'll only let Nina in? That should be fine. At least Nina will be safe if they let her in, you think. But the thought of leaving her makes you feel ill. You're surprised by how attached you are to her. She is having your child. She calls you her family. You look at her lovingly, and she returns your look, putting her arm over her belly. You see the mammoths. You see the huge, magnificent creatures walking through the hills in great columns. They are majestic with huge, curling tusks and domed heads and backs. There is a peacefulness to them. They seem to you like pious monks slowly walking in meditation. Strong in their numbers and their incredible size, there is nothing that can hurt them, neither beasts nor winter. Not even humans. They are the majestic creatures of the Ice Age, a symbol of this world and a symbol of its parting. And there is the tribe. Great huts made of mammoth bone and clay described by the men fill the valley. There are people, so many people. Children laughing and playing, women going about their business, men meeting with friends. Some people are hauling in sleighs of mammoth meat, while others are firing clay pots in outdoor furnaces. Some people are gathered together, napping stone tools, while others are working the long, curved mammoth tusks, preparing them for tools, art, and building supplies. You look over to Nina, afraid that her razor instinct will warn you to keep moving. But she smiles back at you. Catching your inquisitive glance, she says, "It's safe. we will raise our family here. Holding hands, we walk down the hill towards the village together. Your body starts to tingle and the world is swaying. You feel sick to your stomach, and you find it difficult to walk straight. You tell Nina you feel dizzy and need to sit down. Are you okay? She asks, but her voice is miles away. You have a choice. The words form in your head, but they aren't yours. You have a choice. Will you return home, or will you stay? You have to decide now.
What you just heard was Ice Age Misery. It's not the first Twilight History show, but it is the first among a few experiments using different styles and different time machines. The very first concept involved a flying time machine, modeled after the one used by H.G. Wells. It was cool because you could travel all over the world you were visiting, forwards and backwards in time, and to different places of interest along the way. That had its perks, for sure. But the one reason I changed it was because it didn't quite allow for that full immersion I was going for. You could stop and check things out, but it was more as a whistle-stop tourist racing through a world than what I was really hoping for, a full immersive experience, something where you're dropped off and left to fend for yourself. So I took those early shows down. You can still hear them. They're in our Patreon area, and there are three of them. The very first one I ever created is called Lord of the Flies, where you get to experience the collapse of the Bronze Age firsthand. The second show takes place in a Rome that industrializes before your eyes. The last story is called Access Earth, and as the name implies, you get to watch the world turn fascist. Here's a short sample from Rome Industrial. You've been walking through the streets of ancient Rome for hours, and you still haven't gotten used to the smell. The thick scent of urine and feces wafts through the sewer streets, and the alleys and doorways are pungent with last night's revelry. In the street markets, a thick harvest of flies covers the fruits, vegetables, cheeses, and meats, so they're a mass of moving creatures. And the people of Rome are poor. The contrast between the great towering monuments and the rabble that scour beneath is startling. Makeshift markets spring up under temples where poverty-stricken plebs sell baked goods, used clothing and utensils under filthy canvas awnings. The sick and dying are on display in the streets, begging for alms on every corner, while pickpockets work their unsuspecting clients. The lepers bell chimes for the streets to clear, and the dead are thrown on garbage heaps, waiting for some compassionate soul to drag them to the river. You wander through most of the center of town, through the forums of Trajan, Caesar, and Augustus, where some of the more upscale shops fill the Stoics. You see the old temples, the Senate House, and the Mausoleum of Augustus, with its cap of cypress trees further on. You walk up the Aventine through middle-class streets and see spread before you the Circus Maximus, and beyond that, the Imperial Palace mounted like a cathedral on its lofty hill. Your stomach is rumbling,
and you follow your nose to some street food. You find a canteen in the bottom floor of an insula, a rickety six-story wood and brick tenement building on the Aventine. There's a bar in the canteen where men are standing, sipping fish soup with bread and drinking cheap wine mixed with water. You order yourself a cup of wine, a foul, tart drink, and listen to the conversations around you. A group of men are talking about the war with the Germanic tribes.
If you enjoyed that and you want to hear more, please head on over to our Patreon page. When you join, you'll gain instant access to those three early shows, plus many more stories spanning so many years. Bonus shows, experiments that didn't quite work out, pre-releases, shorts, and even a stillborn podcast I created called Dark Histories that I never launched. Patreon is how we keep the Twilight Histories going. So if you value this podcast and you want to support us in creating more stories for you well into the future, please consider becoming a supporting patron. You can find a link to our Patreon page by visiting the website at twilighthistories.com. That's twilighthistories, plural.com. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thank you for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.